Our generation has been blessed in so many different ways, but one of the incredible things that we have is the gift of having such tremendous access to Svarim and to Torah literature of every kind, Hashkafa and Halacha and Gemara, and it's online, and you can buy the Art Scroll iPad, and you can find Svarim that previous generations never used to be able to even be aware of, forget about, read, or learn from. It's phenomenal, but at the same time, it becomes a little bit difficult for us to discern who exactly is a real Talmud Chacham Bizman Hazeh, and who is just a charlatan and a fraud and picking things off of the internet and not really a Talmud Chacham at all. And people can easily claim to be something that they are not really, just by virtue of the fact that it's so easy to search or find anything in our generation. My father has told me on many occasions when I spoke to him about this issue, he said, the best way to prove that somebody is a real Talmud Chacham is when you have a discussion with them and some issue in Halacha comes up or any other issue, if they can bring a Raya from a Gemara or a Maimer Chazal, that means they're a Talmud Chacham. If you know the Gemara, you know the Sugyas well enough to bring a Raya, to bring a proof to a discussion that you're having and learning, then that means you're a real Talmud Chacham. So if someone could do that, that means that they're real, it means that they're genuine. I think that this evening, I know that we generally try to go through a different Shaila every week that has come up, but I think the entire Torah world has focused their attention, rightfully so, on the tragic patira of Reb Chaim Kanievsky. So people have said, it's not such a tragedy. He was 94 years old. At some point, you know, a 94-year-old is not going to live forever. So Rav Asher Weiss, I think, had an amazing perspective on that. And he said, you know, when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the Gemara says, Kasha misasan shel tzadikim kisreif has Beis Elokeinu. It says that in some way it's similar. When you have the Misa, the death of a tzaddik, in some way it's synonymous to Sreif has Beis Elokeinu. So when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, did anybody say, you know, it was around for 400 years. Like, how long do you think a building is going to last? At some point, you're going to have to do repairs. At some point, you're going to have to knock it down, demolish it, and create a new infrastructure. Obviously, it can't last forever. Nobody asked such a silly question, because that's just a silly question. Everything that the Beis HaMikdash represents is so important to us that when we lost it, nobody was thinking about how old it was and how long it was going to last. It was something that was such a fundamental aspect of Jewish life. And that is the same with Talmidei Chachamim. So I thought it was an opportunity. I know many, many great people have given hespedim, whether they knew Reb Chaim or they didn't. They read about him. They knew personal stories or impersonal stories, whatever it may be. He was extremely impactful on our lives in so many different ways. And I thought this evening, maybe Lekavod de Petira of Reb Chaim, it was an opportunity for us just to highlight a tiny glimpse of the godless of what it really means to be a person who is sholeit b'kol haTorah kula. What does it mean to be a person who has a mastery of everything, that whenever you're having a discussion in any area of halacha, you can bring a proof to something else? So, by way of introduction, there's a comment of the Talmud Yerushalmi in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, and it has become a very famous comment that tells us, Divrei Torah aniyim b'makom echad, ashirim b'makom acher. Sometimes you learn something, and you find out a certain piece of information from what you've learned. But if you look somewhere else, you'll find out a lot more about the topic, and unbeknownst to you, you just haven't gotten there yet. So I think a great way to understand this is, you know, nowadays it's interesting. We have people who claim to be bekiyim, who claim to be experts on very specific areas of halacha, right? So you can go take a course, and you can become an expert in basar b'chalav. You can become an expert in hilchas nida. You can become an expert in hilchas mikvos, or all these different things. And it's very nice, and it's admirable that people are willing to put their minds or focus to a particular topic, a particular area or set of halachas, and to try to master it to the best of their ability. The problem with that is that if you have no awareness of other areas of halacha, sometimes you need to know a different area of halacha to shed light on this area of halacha. For example, Hilchas Nida is a great example. Sometimes in Hilchas Nida, you have a certain kula b'shas adchak. How are you going to know what's a shas adchak? Well, if you're not familiar with other areas of halacha and how we define what a shas adchak is, how can you say you're an expert in this if you don't know that? So here's a great example, just to bring the point home. I came up with a few examples this afternoon as I was preparing the shir, and I think it's fascinating. If you go through the entire Maseches Brachos, the Gemara Brachos, and you learn it cover to cover, and you know it baal peh, you know the whole thing by heart, you still will not know what bracha you're supposed to make on beer that is produced from barley. How interesting is that? You have to look in a separate mesechta. So where are you going to look? What's the second choice? So if it's not in brachas, where should it be? Somewhere else in Moed, somewhere close. No, it's in the middle of Maseches Baba Basra, Daf Tzadivav, in the middle of something else, where the Gemara tells us that if you have beer that is made from barley, you're going to make a bracha of shahakol. So that's a great example. Divrei Torah, aniyim b'makom echad, ashirim b'makom acher. I'm the biggest bucky on Hilchos Brachos. I know everything. I learned the Masechta inside out. But you still don't know a simple question. I ask you, what bracha do we make on beer? And you look through the whole Masechta, you don't know the answer. You go to Maseches Peah. It's the second of the Masechtas in Mishnayos. And there, you ask yourself a question. Is Peah something that we only have as an applicable mitzvah in Eretz Yisrael? Or is it noeg even in Chutz La'aretz? You would think, if I go through all the Mishnayos very well and I know it by heart, I would probably know the answer to that question. The answer is found in Maseches Chulin, Daf Kuf Lamed Zayin, where the Gemara there has a discussion whether Peah is something that applies only in Eretz Yisrael or even in Chutz La'aretz. Maybe there's a Chiyuv min derabbanan. Maybe we should attach it to the mitzvah of Eretz Yisrael, or perhaps not. You go to Maseches Challah, right? We're all familiar with the mitzvah of Hafrashas Challah. So I have a question. Challah b'zman hazeh, when we don't have a Beis HaMikdash and we don't live in Eretz Yisrael, we live here in Chutz La'aretz. Is that a mitzvah d'oraisa, a mitzvah d'rabbanan? So you go through all of Maseches Challah, you won't find the answer, because you have to look at Maseches Ksubas and Maseches Nida, where the Gemara has a discussion whether or not this is a mitzvah d'oraisa or d'rabbanan b'zman hazeh. How can that be? It's fascinating. I hope I don't bore anyone with these examples, but I find it amazingly fascinating. Maseches Shabbos, right? I know Hilchos Shabbos inside out, upside down, until I get to a point where the Gemara comes to a story of what happens on Mevashel Achola B'Shabbos. We know that in order to do work for Achola on Shabbos, if his life is really in danger, you're allowed to do whatever he needs. So if the doctor prescribes a chicken soup that he needs to eat something, drink something, whatever, I'm allowed to shecht an animal, I'm allowed to cook some food, whatever the chola is going to need. So what if I'm a vasha l'chola b'Shabbos? Is somebody else allowed to eat from that which I've cooked on Shabbos on behalf of the chola or not? You'll say, I'll look in Maseches Shabbos. The answer is you won't find it. In Maseches Chulin, Daf Tezvav, the Gemara has the answer to that question. Interesting, right? You can keep going like this. Every Masechta is the same thing. Are you allowed to have a suda on Erev Shabbos? You would think somewhere in the Gemara in Shabbos it's going to talk about this. When the Gemara talks about all the other things, about not going to a barber on Erev Shabbos, it's the first parak in Maseches Shabbos. But no, that's a Gemara Maseches Gittin in the middle of the fifth parak where it says that there was a family who used to have a suda on Erev Shabbos and they were punished for it because when a Shabbos came, they had no appetite left to eat anything. So this is a fascinating reality that we find. The Gemara tells us in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, Maseches Yuma, we know that every year there's a mitzvah of giving Machzis HaShekel. Why do we give Machzis HaShekel? Because we need to buy karbanos, and the karban has to be offered on behalf of the entire Jewish community. So how could it be? Every Jew is going to come with a karban every day? Of course not. So everybody gives a machzis hashekel, and we take from the collective whole every day, and we buy the karbanos that are offered on behalf of all of us. So you learn Maseches Shkalim, and it's all about the machzis hashekel. It's all about the details. And yet, what happens if I have shkalim that are left over from last year? Am I allowed to use them for the karban this year or not? Rosh Hashanah already passed. So now it's a new cycle, and we collect a new machzis hashekel, not Rosh Hashanah, Nisan. So what would you say? Would I be allowed to use the shkalim from last year to buy karbanos now? Or do you say, no, we start a new cycle, and whatever money is left over has to go somewhere else? You would think, you look at Maseches Rosh Hashanah, Maseches Shkalim, you'll find it. No, it's a Gemara Maseches Yuma that talks about the details of Machzis HaShekel as something that you don't find there. Kahena v'chahena, is there an Isser Muktzah on Yom Kippur? Not in Maseches Yuma. The discussion about Muktzah on Yom Kippur is something that you find in Maseches Rosh Hashanah. Nothing at all to do with Yom Kippur, but the Gemara there gets into a discussion. I would ask you, we have to blow shofar in Rosh Hashanah. So the last parak in Rosh Hashanah talks about all the details of shofar, and yet we don't know how big does the shofar need to be. Look through all the Masechta, you won't find it, because the Gemara has this in Maseches Nida, where the Gemara says you have to have a shofar that's large enough that if you hold it in your hand with a fist, it has to have some of it coming out in the front, some of it that comes out protrudes in the back. That is the shear of a shofar that you could do the mitzvah on Rosh Hashanah with. The Gemara says in Megillah, would a woman be allowed to be motzi a man in the mitzvah of Mikra Megillah? That should have been a Maseches Megillah. That's where we talk about all the halachas. But no, it's a Maseches Erech and Daf Gimel. Fascinating. So this is the way halacha works, that you have to know one area, but it's not good enough to know one area, because you never know if you're missing a different Masechta or you're missing a different set of halachas. You really can be missing a whole lot about the details of this particular set of halachas as well. And that is the greatness of somebody who's sholeit b'chala Torah kula. If you know everything, everything's clear. And you know how to draw a comparison from somewhere else. So I just want to give a few examples. There's a story that's quoted in the Sefer Pnine Rabbeinu Bala Kehilas Yaakov. That is a collection of halachos, of different things, interesting tidbits from the Stipler Gaon. The Stipler was Reb Chaim Kanievsky's father, obviously. He was a great gadol on his own right. He was the brother-in-law of the Chazon Ish. That's not why he was great. He was great on his own. His brother-in-law happened to be the Chazon Ish. His son happened to be Reb Chaim Kanievsky. His mechutin happened to be Rabbi Yashiv. But none of those things are connected. He was a great man in his own right. And the story goes that one year, before Pesach, it was already Chodesh Nisan. Now, we have a minig every year, the Shulchan Aruch says, that when Chodesh Nisan comes, and you see the Ilani Dimalavluvi, you see the trees are beginning to blossom, so we go outside and we recite a bracha. Beautiful bracha, gives us the opportunity to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for a new season, wonderful, so we make this bracha. So the story that's printed in the Sefer is that Rab Chaim Kanievsky was a young man, I don't know how young he was, but probably in his 30s or so, and he goes out together with his father in the beginning of Chodesh Nisan to make the bracha on the trees. They obviously didn't have trees right in their backyard, so they went out to some block somewhere. Just so happens that also happened to be the day when they were having the cycle of the 28 years when they say the Birchas Hachama. So they got into a whole discussion there, and they asked each other, should you make the Birchas Hachama first, or should you first make the Birchas HaIlanos? We have two brachas that we need to make. We have a bracha on the sun, comes along every 28 and a half years, and we have a bracha on the Ilanos, comes around once a year. So what would you say, which one should be first? So the Gemara says, a klal, tadav sheno tadav tadav kodem. Now normally that means something that I do all the time takes precedence to something that I don't do all the time. So here, what's all the time? Once a year is considered all the time in when you're talking in relative terms to 28 and a half years. So the Stipler said we should first make the bracha on the Ilanos, on the trees, because we do this every year in Nisan, and only subsequently should we make the bracha on the... Only after that should we make the bracha on the... Okay. Only after that should we make the bracha... Special effect, I got it. Only after that should we make a bracha on the Chama. That was what the Stipler said. Makes a lot of sense. Reb Chaim argued and he said it's a mistake. Why? Because although it's true, tadav sheno tadav tadav kodem, and if you're looking at that factor alone, you would say that one comes once a year and one of them comes 28 years, but he said it's not true. Because what bracha do we make? What's the nusach bracha that we make when you look at the sun every 28 years? Anybody know? You don't remember. Osam Aisa Bereshis. Osam Aisa Bereshis is something that's not limited to seeing the sun. If you see a beautiful ocean, if you see the Grand Canyon, if you see all kinds of different amazing natural phenomenon, you make a bracha Osam Aisa Bereshis. A seder of Chaim, this is more tadir. Because Osam Aisa Bereshis you can make 10 times a year. And the bracha on the Ilanos you only make once a year. So that's what he argued to his father. And his father said back, it's not true. How can you say that? This bracha on the sun, although it's the same nusach that we make somewhere else, that's not the same machayiv, it's not the same obligation that I have. And therefore he said, you cannot compare that. That doesn't come into the equation. It's true. Once in a while you make a bracha on the Grand Canyon, and once in a bracha on a big river, a big ocean, all kinds of different things, a big mountain. But that has nothing to do with the sun. So it's the same nusach bracha, but it's not the same. So Reb Chaim brought a raya from a Gemara Maseches Sukkah. Nothing to do with anything. So what's the raya? So the Gemara says in Maseches Sukkah, Daf Nun Vav, a fascinating discussion regarding how we're supposed to say the brachas on Leil Sukkahs. So what comes first? Do we first say the bracha of Leishe Basukah, or do we first say the bracha of Shechiyanu? So we know that we have a major discussion. It depends if it's during the day, at night. Machaber and the Ramah has a whole discussion about it. But the Gemara itself says that you first make a Shechiyanu, and then you make a Leishe Basukah. Why? Why do you make Shechiyanu first? Because Shechiyanu is more tadir. Shechiyanu we do more often. Why do we do it more often? Every time is a yantif. But the Shechiyanu that I made on Sukkot has nothing to do with Pesach. It's the same bracha, but it has nothing to do. The mechayiv of my Shechiyanu today is only because today is Pesach. I'm sorry, today is Sukkot. What does that have to do with Pesach? What does that have to do with Rosh Hashanah? What does that have to do with Yom Kippur? It has nothing to do with anything. Happens to be it's the same nusach. Reb Chaim said, you see from the Gemara, when you have the same nusach bracha, even though it comes from a totally different source, that is considered to be more tadir, and that will determine which one comes first. That is a real Talmud Chacham. That's what it means to be someone who's shalei b'kol haTorah kuli. You can look in a source that has no connection at all to what we're discussing, and you can dig up something that sheds light on the discussion that we're having. Maybe hold the questions because we don't have so much time. So there was a stimulating shaila that was raised by a staff member of Chinuch Atzmai. Chinuch Atzmai, for those of us who are not familiar, they try to go around into different neighborhoods, and they have chiloni parents sign their children up to come to Orthodox Jewish day schools in Eretz Yisrael. So, it's a very successful enterprise, a very successful group of people who are working on it. So the question was as follows. There was once a Rebbe in one of these Chinuch Atzmai yeshivas who knocks on the door of a Chiloni family, and he's having a whole discussion. Maybe you want to enroll your children next year. We're not going to charge you any tuition. We'll give a great education. The kid's going to come out looking like all these other kids. It's going to be wonderful, great, and he'll grow up to be a wonderful person. So the father's listening to the whole discussion. He says, maybe I'll think about it. Okay. As the Rebbe is walking out of the house, he notices on the front door there's no mezuzah. And for that matter, on any of the doors of the house, there's no mezuzah. So he turns to the father, he says, look, you know, we have a very nice discussion. I'm just curious, would you be interested in putting up a mezuzah? So the man says, what's a mezuzah? I don't even know what it is. So he starts explaining to him. He says, you know, it costs money. He's like, I'm not spending money on this, for sure not. He says, no, I'm going to buy the mezuzah for you. I'll come back and I'll give it to you. He says, I'm not getting involved. You want to come back, put a mezuzah up and do it on your own. Do whatever you want. I'm not going to say anything. Make sure it's nice, but I'm not going to do anything. So he says, fine, if you give me your permission, I'll go to the store, I'll buy a mezuzah, I'll put it on the front door. Fine, that's what they made up. Now we had a shaila, am I allowed to make a bracha when I'm putting up a mezuzah for someone who didn't ask me to do it? He said, do whatever you want. So if he makes me his shaliach, if he puts me in his place and asks me, can you do the mitzvah on my behalf? So then of course I can make a bracha. For example, we know that when we do Mikra Megillah, not everybody knows that Elaine. So we send somebody up to do the Mikra Megillah for us. He makes the bracha on my behalf. He's my shaliach. But over here, am I allowed to make a bracha on something that I wasn't even instructed to do? I'm doing it on my own. But it's not my mitzvah, it's his mitzvah. So am I allowed to make a bracha? That was the interesting question that was raised. So when it comes to the mitzvah mezuzah, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Psachim that mezuzah chovas hadar. The obligation of mezuzah is not on the person who walks by in the street. The obligation of mezuzah is on the person who lives in the house. If you live in the house, you have to put up a mezuzah. It's actually an interesting question that's raised by one of the Achronim, I can't remember who, someone recently, who discusses, maybe I should have the same way we have an obligation to buy a nice esrog box because it's a hiddur mitzvah, and the same way I have a nice menorah because I want to do a hiddur mitzvah for Hadlakas Neiros Chanukah, so maybe I should build a beautiful home as a hiddur mitzvah for the mitzvah mezuzah. It's a good argument. Right? What? People hold of it. Yeah. So it's an interesting question. Anyway, so we know mezuzah is a chovas hadar.
What about
So zachan l'adam shelo b'fanav just means I'm allowed to be makna something, I'm allowed to give something to you if you don't want it. That's fine. But can I go ahead and actually make a bracha when I'm doing that? So you'll argue, so the Achronim have a big discussion about Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and others. Well, Zachna Shlomo Bafanov is not exactly what they say, but they say, Midin Arvus, what do you mean? The same way I have a chiv do the mitzvah, you have a chiv do the mitzvah, I should do it for you. So of course I can make a bracha back and forth. A lot of discussion in the Achronim. Okay, along comes Reb Chaim Kanievsky and he says, why don't you just look in the source? You'll find an answer. So where are you going to find the answer? You look in Hilchas Mezuzah, you won't find the answer. Where's the answer? He said, you make a diuk in the Mishnah Berurah and the Bir Halacha. First of all, you have to know the Mishnah Berurah by heart to know this. Even if you learned all the Mishnah Berurahs, not everybody focuses on all the Bir Halacha. Bir Halacha is complicated. So he looks in the Bir Halacha, and where's the Bir Halacha? Not where it should be. It's in Hilchos Erev Tavshilin. So what's in Hilchos Erev Tavshilin? So the Halacha is that the Rav Ha'ir, in every community, when you have the obligation to make an Erev Tavshilin, so the rabbi of the community is not only supposed to make an Erev Tavshilin for himself, like everybody else does, but he's also supposed to have in mind to make an Erev Tavshilin for anybody in town who forgot, and that's going to count for them. Okay, says the Mishnah Berurah, what happens if the rabbi already made his Erev Tavshilin? He forgot about his responsibility, as a responsibility to the tzibur, but he forgot about it. So he makes his Erev Tavshilin. Then it's 5 minutes to Yantiv, and he says, oh yeah, I forgot all about it. Maybe I should make one for everybody else. So now he wants to make an Erev Tavshilin for everyone else, but he's not sure. Is there anyone else who actually needs this? Maybe everybody remembered. Now, that's impossible that everybody in town remembered. But again, the Mishnah Berurah is talking about a shtetl where you have 25 people, not here where you have 1,000 people, so it's very different. So you have 25 people. What's the likelihood that somebody forgot? Maybe yes, maybe no. So the Mishnah Berurah says he probably shouldn't make a bracha because he's not sure whether or not somebody actually needs this. So he's not allowed to make a bracha. Said Reb Chaim Kanievsky, what can you infer from that? What can you infer? You can infer that if one of the people in town certainly didn't make a bracha, certainly didn't make an Erev Tavshilin, and I'm doing it for him, even though he didn't ask me to do it, I'm doing the mitzvah for him. I wasn't instructed. He didn't send me as a shaliach. But you can infer from what the Mishnah Berurah says that if I know with certainty that somebody didn't make an Erev Tavshilin, even though I already made one on my own with a bracha, I'd be allowed to subsequently make a bracha again on behalf of the person who I'm helping. That's a raya to our case. That you see, when I'm doing a mitzvah for someone, even if they didn't instruct me to be involved in this, I did it on my own just to help them out, I would still make a bracha because I'm benefiting them, I'm helping them, even though I was not at all asked to be their shaliach, I was not asked to be in any official capacity at all. There was a very interesting shaila about a person who was involved in a pigua, and we know that there was a horrible pigua yesterday in Be'er Sheva. It's so disturbing, it's so upsetting. And the loss of life every time is such a tragedy. But yesterday, you know, young mothers and a young father, it's just such an upsetting scene that we all saw. So the question was that there was a pigua, and unfortunately there was somebody who, as a result of the injuries that he sustained, became severely handicapped. And what was his handicap? that he was no longer able to use his arm, that he had developed a gangrenous arm. As a result, he was paralyzed and he was unable to use his arm any longer. And the question then became, when it comes to many different things, it becomes a problem. Tefillin and all these kinds of issues. But the question that he raised that first came to his mind was, what does he do on Sukkot when it comes time to shake the Dalet Minim? So I guess the tefillin issue was not an issue because it was on the other arm. So what does he do when it comes Dalet Minim and he's supposed to hold it with both hands? He's supposed to shake with both hands. So what does he do? I don't remember if the details were that he had a prosthetic and it was just he had a stump on the top that was connected to it. I don't remember exactly what it was, but something, his arms, his hands were not working as they once were. So the question then became, would he be allowed to use whatever he now has in place of his hands, would he be allowed to make use of that or not? So there's a whole discussion about ulakachtem. What does it mean when it says that you're supposed to take the dalet minim? It means you have to take them in your hands. So Tosfos says, what happens if a person, for whatever reason, you have very slippery skin, or the esrog is very slippery, and it keeps slipping out of your hands? You just can't get a grip on it. For whatever reason, it's too big, it's too slippery, so you're going to take a towel, and you're going to wrap it around the esrog, and this way you're going to hold it, and that will work. So Tosfos says, that would be permissible. Why? Tosfos writes himself, and if the reason why you're doing it is in order that you should be able to hold the dalet minim in a more perfected fashion, and otherwise you can't do it, so that's a hemshech of the mitzvah. That's a connection to the mitzvah. That's how I'm supposed to be doing the mitzvah, because I have no other way of doing it. So Tosfos says that that would be the same, that would be permissible. That would not be a chisaron. That would not be a problem of somebody who takes his lulav and esrog that way. So the question then became, would that translate into this case? You have somebody whose hand does not work at all. Somebody who's paralyzed. So is that considered to be his hand? Is that the same as taking a towel and wrapping it around the dalet minim? If somebody has a prosthetic arm, if somebody has a bionic arm, is that considered to be a acceptable form of doing the mitzvah of dalet minim? Or do you say the person is patur from the mitzvah? He doesn't have hands anymore. What should he do? So this was a major discussion. The poskim of our generation all said whatever they said. Along came Reb Chaim Kanievsky and he said, what are you all standing on your heads to figure it out? There's a Yerushalmi, where the Yerushalmi tells an amazing story. So the Yerushalmi is in Maseches Yuma. Again, nothing at all to do with this situation here, but he drew an analysis, a comparison from this story to the case over here. So the Yerushalmi says, Maisa be'echad, there was a Kohen, Sheyav Shazro, that he was in the middle of being Maktir the Ketor, he was in the middle of doing the Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash, he was being Ovid in the Karbanos, and in the middle, as he's doing the Avodah, everything's going fine, all of a sudden he gets some kind of disease in his arteries, and he has poor circulation, and all of a sudden his arm becomes paralyzed in the middle. He has a stroke, whatever it may be, and the Rishalmi describes the story, how he's in the middle, and he's still holding on to whatever he's doing, holding on to the blood, bringing it to the Mizbeach, and he says, I'm not giving up, and he continues to walk to the Mizbeach, and he uses his hands that aren't working, and he goes ahead, and he continues and finishes off the Avodah. L'kayim ha-shanemar, and the Yerushalmi says, on such a person we say, Baruch Hashem chelo ufo'al yadav tirtzeh. He decided he's going to use his hands even if they don't work. Asked Reb Chaim, if the hands don't work, you're a Baal Mum. If you can't use your hands, you can't do the Avodah. So how is he allowed to continue the Avodah? So obviously, says Reb Chaim, you see that if somebody has hands that don't work, you see that he's allowed to continue to do the Avodah. If he's allowed to do the Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash, he's allowed to shake lulav as well. What's the difference? So again, it's not so simple, because if you look in the Yerushalmi, not everyone agrees that that's pshat in the Gemara. But whatever it is, just the fact that you can have an instant recall, and you can just draw something from the middle of nowhere. First of all, how many people in their lives ever learned the Yerushalmi? So he learned the Yerushalmi every year, all the Yerushalmi. So he knew it baal peh. But to know it in such a way where you can just call upon it at any time. So there's another fascinating story, so many stories we can say. But I'm trying to just get the point across a little bit. So there was a kid whose parents had gotten divorced. He was 2 years old or 3 years old when his parents got divorced. And his Baruch Hashem, his mother got remarried, his father got remarried, everyone moved on in their own directions, everyone was fine, it was a very clean divorce. But at the time, the father was really unable to take care of his young 2-year-old child. It wasn't appropriate. His new wife had so many young children, and it didn't work out. So the way it worked was he had visitation, let's say once a week, or whatever it may have been, but his wife is the one who raised the children. Her and her husband took care of everything. And the stepfather completely provided, supported, and tended to all the needs of this child for his whole life. And here he was, he's 22 years old, he starts going out in Shidduchim, and he didn't just live in his stepfather's home, he didn't just live off of his stepfather and all the tuitions and everything else, but he also took on the name of his stepfather. He really had very limited relationship with his father. He was living in his mother and his stepfather's house, and that's the way he went. In school, all the years, that's the way it was. So Now, out of nowhere, the son gets not out of nowhere. The son gets engaged, and out of nowhere, the father shows up and he says, "You know, I'd like to be involved in the wedding plans. And by the way, on the invitation, you are not going to write your stepfather's name as your last name. You're going to write my name as your last name." And the child was very torn. He said, "You know, I love my father. He is my father. But after all, my stepfather is the one who took care of me all the years. My father didn't do anything. He took no responsibility. So what am I going to say now? I'm going to start giving my father credit for raising me as my father, and I'm going to write on the invitation his last name instead of my stepfather. I'm going to take him off the invitation. Does that really make sense? Can that really be?" So this is an interesting question. So the Gemara says in Bava Metzia, when it comes to the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda, so it's pretty straightforward. I find something, says somebody's name on it, I have an obligation to go to the person's house and return it. Easy. Now, says the Gemara, what happens if I only have 5 minutes, and I can only return one item that I find? And I see two suitcases here. One suitcase says my father's name. It's not a good example, because my father is not a good example here. But what if I have somebody else's father, right? Somebody else has their father, and they also have Avedas Rabo. So I have my Rebbe's suitcase, and I have my father's suitcase. So which one should I return? What? So in my case, it's the same. I made it simpler, I know. But in most people's case, it's not the same. So what are you supposed to do? So what does the Gemara say? The Gemara says the Rebbe's suitcase should be returned, and the father should be left behind. Why? So the Gemara says, because Rabo mevi'o l'chayo l'manbo. My father gets a lot of credit for bringing me into this world. My Rebbe, he brought me into Olam Haba. He taught me Torah. Look what he did to my life. He made me into a mensch. He did everything for me. He put me on the right path. He taught me how to do mitzvahs and how to live my life like a Jew. Okay, so the Rebbe comes first before the father. Okay, that's the halach in the Gemara. Right, the Shach, not so simple. It's not always that way. So the Shach says, it's interesting, my father tells a story that he once went to a wedding in Toronto, and he said that he landed from the airport, he went into somebody's house, wherever he was staying, and they sat him down, they gave him something to eat, and he said, the husband who answered the door calls up to his wife, "You know, Rabbi Schechter's here, he just landed." So the wife says, "Where is Rabbi Schechter?" She's screaming from upstairs, she comes downstairs, and she says to him, "Are you Rabbi Schechter?" He says, "Yes." So she says, "Are you the one who told my son that if my things are missing and his and your things are missing, that you come first? And are you the one who said that the Gemara says that if I'm drowning in the river and he's drowning in the river, he's going to save you and not me?" So he said it's true, but the Shach qualifies the statement. He says not so simple. It's true. If one's father brings him into the world and then stops there, so you're right. The Rebbe is more important than the father. However, writes the Shach, what if the father pays tuition? So the Rebbe's not doing this for free. He's not doing it as a favor. He's doing it because he's hired by the school. Now who's paying the tuition? Parents are paying the tuition. So then the parents are not out of the equation. Parents didn't just bring the child into the world and drop them and say, "All right, now you're on your own and you're in your Rebbe's hands." Of course not. It's a partnership. The Rebbe's teaching, but I'm paying the Rebbe to teach you. So then I get saved. I, as the father, am the one who's responsible for not only bringing you into Olam Hazeh, but also Olam Haba. I, the Rebbe, is the one who's teaching you. Yeah, but I'm facilitating the Rebbe to teach you. If I wasn't paying the tuition, you wouldn't be able to go to yeshiva. So the Shach writes clearly, if I'm the one paying tuition, then this whole equation of the Gemara goes out the window, and it's not a direct comparison anymore. If we're talking about someone who is mevi'o l'chayo olam hazeh versus chayo olam haba, so then olam haba comes first. But if you have somebody who brings you into olam hazeh and olam haba versus somebody who only is involved in olam haba, then of course the father will come first. There's nothing to discuss. And that's a simple equation. That's what the Shach writes. So that's what my father responded at the time to this woman. You're right. The Gemara does say that. But if you pay tuition in YU, then obviously we would save you first, and we would disregard the Rebbe. Anyway, be it as it may. What? He got his meal. He was finished eating before she came. So anyway, so that just gives us a little bit of a picture here. So here you have a stepfather who's paying the tuition, who's raising the child, who's doing everything. You can't say he's just an outsider who's being a nice person. He takes over the role. And we see that that's a very significant role. We see that that plays a major factor when it comes to other halachas. So here the question was, what would the halacha be? Would the child have to go out of his way to now start worrying about his father, who he has no relationship with, at the expense of his stepfather, who's done everything for him? Does he have to now drop his last name that he's had for the last 20 years and everything else that came along with it? So Reb Chaim Kanievsky said absolutely not. And how do we know? He said because you look in the Ramah and Hilchos Shtoros and Choshen Mishpat. So what does the Ramah say? So the Ramah says, what happens if somebody is Megadol Yasam Besoch Beso? Somebody who adopts a foster child and brings up this child, raises his child like it's his own. And then he writes a will, and in the will he says, "I'd like my son to get X amount for my Yerusha." Well, I shouldn't have said my son. Should have said my stepson. Should have said my adopted child. It's not really your son. So you didn't write that. So the Rama says, that's not a problem. Why? Because that's what everybody says. If I raise the child in my house, and in the end I write, this is my son. I come into shul with the kid. Everybody asks, who's that? I say, it's my son. That's the way I introduce him to everyone. So if I write in the shtar, then that means the same thing. And the same goes in the opposite direction. If the son writes a shtar, so the son writes a document, and in the document he says, I want to award my father X, Y, and Z. So who does he mean? He means the father is raising him. For all intents and purposes, that's a father. Said Reb Chaim Kanievsky, that person is considered your father, even if he's not your biological father, but that's the way we refer to it. So what right does a father, a biological father, have to come along here and say, we're going to take the stepfather out of the equation, who did everything to raise you, who did everything to bring you to the place where you are, and you're going to take him out of the equation now? The Rama clearly says that for all intents and purposes, this is called your father. And for all intents and purposes, this is called the person who raised you, and you are called his son. And that would be something that is so clear, that would be something that is not an issue at all, and that would not, that again, he brought a proof from a Rama in a very distant, a very remote area of halacha that has no connection at all to what we're discussing here. But yeah, that is the way great Talmidei Chachamim have mastery of all areas of Torah. And sometimes, as we said, aniyim b'makom echad, ashirim b'makom acher. I see that it's already time for Maariv, so we'll stop here. There's so much more, many more hours to say about this topic. But